Disc 5.
The doctor was not smiling now. His face was hard again. Go on. He used some such phrase as, talked as though he believed someone had poisoned me. There was a pause. Had you any suspicion of that kind? Quimper did not answer at once. He got up and walked up and down. Finally, he wheeled round on Craddock. What the devil do you expect me to say? Do you think a doctor can go about flinging accusations of poisoning here and there without any real evidence? I'd just like to know, off the record, if that idea did enter your head. Dr. Quimper said evasively, Old Crackenthorpe leads a fairly frugal life. When the family comes down, Emma steps up the food. Result? A nasty attack of gastroenteritis. The symptoms were consistent with that diagnosis. Craddock persisted. I see. You were quite satisfied? You were not at all, shall we say, puzzled? All right, all right. Yes, I was yours truly puzzled. Does that please you? It interests me, said Craddock. What actually did you suspect or fear? Gastric cases vary, of course, but there were certain indications that would have been, shall we say, more consistent with arsenical poisoning than with plain gastroenteritis. Mind you, the two things are very much alike. Better men than myself have failed to recognize arsenical poisoning, and have given a certificate in all good faith. And what was the result of your inquiries? It seemed that what I suspected could not possibly be true. Mr. Crackenthorpe assured me that he'd had similar attacks before I attended him, and from the same cause, he said. They had always taken place when there was too much rich food about. Which was when the house was full, with the family or guests. Yes. That seemed reasonable enough. But frankly, Craddock, I wasn't happy. I went so far as to write to old Dr. Morris. He was my senior partner and retired soon after I joined him. Crackenthorpe was his patient originally. I asked about these earlier attacks that the old man had had. And what response did you get? Quimper grinned. I got a flea in the ear. I was more or less told not to be a damned fool. Well, he shrugged his shoulders. Presumably I was a damned fool.
I wonder. Craddock was thoughtful. Then he decided to speak frankly. Throwing discretion aside, Doctor, there are people who stand to benefit pretty considerably from Luther Crackenthorpe's death. The doctor nodded. He's an old man, and a hale and hearty one. He may live to be 90-odd. Easily. He spends his life taking care of himself, and his constitution is sound.
And his sons and daughter are all getting on, and they are all feeling the pinch. Now, you leave Emma out a bit. She's no poisoner. These attacks only happen when the others are there, not when she and he are alone.
An elementary precaution, if she's the one, the inspector thought, but was careful not to say aloud. He paused, choosing his words carefully.
Surely, I'm ignorant in these matters, but supposing, just as a hypothesis, that arsenic was administered, hasn't Crackenthorpe been very lucky not to succumb? Now there, said the doctor, you have got something odd. It is exactly that fact that leads me to believe that I have been, as old Morris puts it, a damned fool. You see, it's obviously not a case of small doses of arsenic administered regularly, which is what you might call the classic method of arsenic poisoning. Crackenthorpe has never had any chronic gastric trouble. In a way, that's what makes these sudden violent attacks seem unlikely. So, assuming they are not due to natural causes, it looks as though the poisoner is muffing it every time. Which hardly makes sense. Giving an inadequate dose, you mean? Yes. On the other hand, Crackenthorpe's got a strong constitution, and what might do in another man doesn't do him in. There's always personal idiosyncrasy to be reckoned with. But you'd think that by now the poisoner, unless he's unusually timid, would have stepped up the dose. Why hasn't he? That is, he added, if there is a poisoner, which there probably isn't. Probably all my rally imagination from start to finish. It's an odd problem, the inspector agreed. It doesn't seem to make sense.
Inspector Craddock! The eager whisper made the inspector jump. He had been just on the point of ringing the front doorbell. Alexander and his friend Stoddart West emerged cautiously from the shadows.
We heard your car, and we wanted to get hold of you.
Well, let's come inside. Craddock's hand went out to the doorbell again, but Alexander pulled at his coat with the eagerness of a pawing dog.
We've found a clue, he breathed. Yes, we've found a clue, Stoddart West echoed.
Damn that girl, thought Craddock unamiably. Splendid, he said in a perfunctory manner. Let's go inside the house and look at it.
No, Alexander was insistent. Someone's sure to interrupt. Come to the harness room. We'll guide you.
Somewhat unwillingly, Craddock allowed himself to be guided round the corner of the house and along to the stable yard. Stoddart West pushed open a heavy door, stretched up, and turned on a rather feeble electric light. The harness room, once the acme of Victorian spit and polish, was now the sad repository of everything that no one wanted. Broken garden chairs, rusted old garden implements, a vast decrepit mowing machine, rusted spring mattresses, hammocks, and disintegrated tennis nets.
"We come here a good deal," said Alexander. "One can be really private here."
There were certain tokens of occupancy about. The decayed mattresses had been piled up to make a kind of divan. There was an old rusted table on which reposed a large tin of chocolate biscuits. There was a hoard of apples, a tin of toffee, and a jigsaw puzzle.
"It really is a clue, sir," said Stoddart West eagerly, his eyes gleaming behind his spectacles. "We found it this afternoon. We've been hunting for days. In the bushes and inside hollow trees. And we went all through the ash bins. There were some jolly interesting things there, as a matter of fact. And then we went into the boiler house. Old Hillman keeps a great galvanized tub there full of waste paper for when the boiler goes out and he wants to start it again. Any odd paper that's blowing about, he picks it up and shoves it in there. And that's where we found it."
"Found what?" Craddock interrupted the duet.
"The clue. Careful, Stodders. Get your gloves on."
Importantly, Stoddart West, in the best detective story tradition, drew on a pair of rather dirty gloves and took from his pocket a Kodak photographic folder. From this, he extracted in his gloved fingers with the utmost care a soiled and crumpled envelope, which he handed importantly to the inspector. Both the boys held their breath in excitement. Craddock took it with due solemnity. He liked the boys and was ready to enter into the spirit of the thing. The letter had been through the post. There was no enclosure inside. It was just a torn envelope, addressed to Mrs. Martine Crackenthorpe, 126 Elvis Crescent, N10.
"You see," said Alexander breathlessly, "it shows she was here. Uncle Edmund's French wife, I mean. The one there's all the fuss about. She must have actually been here and dropped it somewhere." "So it looks, doesn't it?" Stoddart West broke in. "It looks as though she was the one who got murdered. I mean, don't you think, sir, that it simply must have been her in the sarcophagus?" They waited anxiously.
Craddock played up. "Possible. Very possible," he said.
"This is important, isn't it? You'll test it for fingerprints, won't you, sir?"
"Of course," said Craddock. Stoddart West gave a deep sigh.
"Smashing luck for us, wasn't it?" he said. "On our last day, too."
"Last day?"
"Yes," said Alexander. "I'm going to Stodder's place tomorrow for the last few days of the holidays. Stodder's people have got a smashing house. Queen Anne, isn't it?" William and Mary, said Stoddart West. I thought your mother said... Mum's French. She doesn't really know about English architecture. But your father said it was built... Craddock was examining the envelope. Clever of Lucy Islesparrow. How had she managed to fake the postmark? He peered closely, but the light was too feeble. Great fun for the boys, of course, but rather awkward for him. Lucy Dratter hadn't considered that angle. If this were genuine, it would enforce a course of action. There, beside him, a learned architectural argument was being hotly pursued. He was deaf to it. Come on, boys, he said. We'll go into the house. You've been very helpful. Chapter 18. Craddock was escorted by the boys through the back door into the house. This was, it seemed, their common mode of entrance. The kitchen was bright and cheerful. Lucy, in a large white apron, was rolling out pastry. Leaning against the dresser, watching her with a kind of dog-like attention, was Brian Eastley. With one hand, he tugged at his large, fair moustache. "Hello, Dad," said Alexander kindly. "You out here again?" "I like it out here," said Brian, and added, "Miss Islesparrow doesn't mind." "Oh, I don't mind," said Lucy. "Good evening, Inspector Craddock." "Coming to detect in the kitchen?" asked Brian with interest. "Not exactly. Mr. Cedric Crackenthorpe is still here, isn't he?" "Oh, yes, Cedric's here. Do you want him?" "I'd like a word with him. Yes, please." "I'll go and see if he's in," said Brian. "He may have gone round to the local." He unpropped himself from the dresser. "Thank you so much," said Lucy to him. "My hands are all over flour, or I'd go." "What are you making?" asked Stoddart West anxiously. "Peach flan." "Good, oh," said Stoddart West. "Is it nearly supper time?" asked Alexander. "No." "Gosh, I'm terribly hungry." "There's the end of the ginger cake in the larder." The boys made a concerted rush and collided in the door. "They're just like locusts," said Lucy. "My congratulations to you," said Craddock. "What on, exactly?" "Your ingenuity over this."
"Over what?"
Craddock indicated the folder containing the letter. "Very nicely done," he said.
"What are you talking about?"
"This, my dear girl, this." He half drew it out. She stared at him uncomprehendingly. Craddock suddenly felt dizzy. "Didn't you fake this clue and put it in the boiler room for the boys to find? Quick, tell me."
"I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about," said Lucy. "Do you mean that..."
Craddock slipped the folder quickly back in his pocket as Brian returned.
"Cedric's in the library," he said. "Go on in."
He resumed his place on the dresser. Inspector Craddock went into the library. Cedric Crackenthorpe seemed delighted to see the inspector.
"Doing a spot more sleuthing down here?" he asked. "Got any further?"
"I think I can say we are a little further on, Mr. Crackenthorpe."
"Found out who the corpse was?"
"We've not got a definite identification, but we have a fairly shrewd idea."
"Good for you."
"Arising out of our latest information, we want to get a few statements. I'm starting with you, Mr. Crackenthorpe, as you're on the spot."
"I shan't be much longer. I'm going back to Ibiza in a day or two."
"Then I seem to be just in time."
"Go ahead."
"I should like a detailed account, please, of exactly where you were and what you were doing on Friday the 20th of December." Cedric shot a quick glance at him. Then he leaned back, yawned, assumed an air of great nonchalance, and appeared to be lost in the effort of remembrance.
"Well, as I've already told you, I was in Ibiza. Trouble is, one day there is so like another. Painting in the morning, siesta from 3 p.m. to 5.
Perhaps a spot of sketching, if the light's suitable. Then an aperitif, sometimes with the mayor, sometimes with the doctor, at the cafe in the piazza. After that, some kind of scratch meal. Most of the evening in Scotty's bar with some of my lower-class friends. Will that do you?
I'd rather have the truth, Mr. Crackenthorpe.
Cedric sat up. That's a most offensive remark, Inspector.
Do you think so?
You told me, Mr. Crackenthorpe, that you left Ibiza on the 21st of December and arrived in England that same day. So I did. Em? Hi, Em.
Emma Crackenthorpe came through the adjoining door from the small morning room. She looked inquiringly from Cedric to the inspector.
Look here, Em. I arrived here for Christmas on the Saturday before, didn't I? Came straight from the airport.
Yes, said Emma wonderingly. You got here about lunchtime.
There you are, said Cedric to the inspector.
You must think us very foolish, Mr. Crackenthorpe, said Craddock pleasantly. We can check on these things, you know. I think if you'll show me your passport... He paused expectantly.
Can't find the damn thing, said Cedric. Was looking for it this morning. Wanted to send it to Cook's.
I think you could find it, Mr. Crackenthorpe, but it's not really necessary. The records show that you actually entered this country on the evening of the 19th of December. Perhaps you will now account to me for your movements between that time until lunchtime on the 21st of December when you arrived here.
Cedric looked very cross indeed. That's a hell of life nowadays, he said angrily. All this red tape and form-filling, that's what comes of a bureaucratic state. Can't go where you like and do as you please anymore. Somebody's always asking questions. What's all this fuss about the 20th, anyway? What's special about the 20th?
It happens to be the day we believe the murder was committed. You can refuse to answer, of course, but...
Who says I refuse to answer? Give a chap time. You were vague enough about the date of the murder at the inquest. What's turned up new since then?
Craddock did not reply. Cedric said, with a sidelong glance at Emma, Shall we go into the other room? Emma said quickly, I'll leave you. At the door, she paused and turned. This is serious, you know, Cedric. If the 20th was the day of the murder, then you must tell Inspector Craddock exactly what you were doing. She went through into the next room and closed the door behind her.
Good old Em, said Cedric. Well, here goes. Yes, I left Ibiza on the 19th, all right. Planned to break the journey in Paris and spend a couple of days routing up some old friends on the left bank. But, as a matter of fact, there was a very attractive woman on the plane. Quite a dish. To put it plainly, she and I got off together. She was on her way to the States, had to spend a couple of nights in London to see about some business or other. We got to London on the 19th. We stayed at the Kingsway Palace, in case your spies haven't found that out yet. Called myself John Brown. Never does to use your own name on these occasions.
And on the 20th?
Cedric made a grimace. Morning pretty well occupied by a terrific hangover.
And the afternoon, from 3 o'clock onwards?
Let me see. Well, I mooned about, as you might say. Went into the National Gallery. That's respectable enough. Saw a film. Rowena of the Range. I've always had a passion for westerns. This was a corker. Then, a drink or two in the bar, and a bit of a sleep in my room, and out about 10 o'clock with a girlfriend, and a round of various hot spots. Can't even remember most of their names. Jumping Frog was one, I think. She knew more. Got pretty well plastered, and, to tell you the truth, don't remember much more till I woke up the next morning, with an even worse hangover. Girlfriend hopped off to catch her plane, and I poured cold water over my head, got a chemist to give me a devil's brew, and then started off for this place, pretending I'd just arrived at Heathrow. No need to upset Emma, I thought. You know what women are. Always hurt if you don't come straight home. I had to borrow money from her to pay the taxi. I was completely cleaned out. No use asking the old man. He'd never cough up. Mean old brute. Well, Inspector, satisfied?
Can any of this be substantiated, Mr. Crackenthorpe? Say, between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m.?
Most unlikely, I should think, said Cedric cheerfully. National Gallery, where the attendants look at you with lackluster eyes, and a crowded picture house. Well, it's not likely.
Emma re-entered. She held a small engagement book in her hand. You want to know what everyone was doing on the 20th of December, is that right, Inspector Craddock?
Well, yes, Miss Crackenthorpe.
I have just been looking in my engagement book. On the 20th, I went into Brackhampton to attend a meeting of the Church Restoration Fund. That finished about 1:45, and I lunched with Lady Addington and Miss Bartlett, who were also on the committee, at the Cadena Cafe. After lunch, I did some shopping, stores for Christmas and also Christmas presents. I went to Greenford's and Lyle and Swift's, Boots, and probably several other shops. I had tea about 4:45 in the Shamrock Tea Rooms, and then went to the station to meet Brian, who was coming by train. I got home about 6 o'clock and found my father in a very bad temper. I had left lunch ready for him, but Mrs. Hart, who was to come in the afternoon and give him his tea, had not arrived. He was so angry that he had shut himself in his room and would not let me in or speak to me. He does not like my going out in the afternoon, but I make a point of doing it now and then.
You're probably wise. Thank you, Miss Crackenthorpe. He could hardly tell her that, as she was a woman, height 5'7", her movements that afternoon were of no great importance. Instead, he said, "Your other two brothers came down later, I understand."
Alfred came down late on Saturday evening. He tells me he tried to ring me on the telephone the afternoon I was out, but my father, if he's upset, will never answer the telephone. My brother Harold did not come down until Christmas Eve.
Thank you, Miss Crackenthorpe.
I suppose I mustn't ask, she hesitated, what has come up new that prompts these inquiries?
Craddock took the folder from his pocket. Using the tips of his fingers, he extracted the envelope. Don't touch it, please. But do you recognize this?
But... Emma stared at him, bewildered. That's my handwriting. That's the letter I wrote to Martine.
I thought it might be.
But how did you get it? Did she... Have you found her?
It would seem possible that we have found her. This empty envelope was found here.
In the house?
In the grounds.
Then she did come here. She... You mean... It was Martine there? In the sarcophagus?
It would seem very likely, Miss Crackenthorpe, said Craddock gently. It seemed even more likely when he got back to town. A message was awaiting him from Armand Dessin. One of the girlfriends has had a postcard from Anna Stravinska. Apparently the crew's story was true. She has reached Jamaica and is having, in your phrase, a wonderful time. Craddock crumpled up the message and threw it into the wastepaper basket.
I must say, said Alexander, sitting up in bed, thoughtfully consuming a chocolate bar, that this has been the most smashing day ever. Actually finding a real clue. His voice was awed. In fact, the whole holiday's been smashing, he added happily. I don't suppose such a thing will ever happen again.
It won't happen again to me, said Lucy, who was on her knees packing Alexander's clothes into a suitcase.
Do you want all this space fiction with you?
Not those two top ones. I've read them. The football and my football boots and the gum boots can go separately. What difficult things you boys do travel with. It won't matter. They're sending the Rolls for us. They've got a smashing Rolls. They've got one of the new Mercedes-Benzes, too.
They must be rich.
Rolling. Jolly nice, too. All the same, I rather wish we weren't leaving here. Another body might turn up. I sincerely hope not. Well, it often does in books. I mean, somebody who's seen something or heard something gets done in too. Might be you, he added, unrolling a second chocolate bar. Thank you. I don't want it to be you, Alexander assured her. I like you very much, and so does Stoddart. We think you're out of this world as a cook. Absolutely lovely grub. You're very sensible, too.
This last was clearly an expression of high approval. Lucy took it as such and said,
Thank you. But I don't intend to get killed just to please you. Well, you'd better be careful, then, Alexander told her.
He paused to consume more nourishment, and then said, in a slightly offhand voice,
If Dad turns up from time to time, you'll look after him, won't you?
Yes, of course, said Lucy, a little surprised.
The trouble with Dad is, Alexander informed her, that London life doesn't suit him. He gets in, you know, with quite the wrong type of women.
He shook his head in a worried manner.
I'm very fond of him, he added, but he needs someone to look after him. He drifts about and gets in with the wrong people. It's a great pity Mum died when she did. Brian needs a proper home life.
He looked solemnly at Lucy and reached out for another chocolate bar. Not a fourth one, Alexander, Lucy pleaded. You'll be sick.
Oh, I don't think so. I ate six running once and I wasn't. I'm not the bilious type.
He paused and then said, Brian likes you, you know.
That's very nice of him. He's a bit of an ass in some ways, said Brian's son, but he was a jolly good fighter pilot. He's awfully brave, and he's awfully good-natured.
He paused. Then, averting his eyes to the ceiling, he said rather self-consciously,
I think, really, you know, it would be a good thing if he married again. Somebody decent. I shouldn't myself mind at all having a stepmother. Not, I mean, if she was a decent sort.
With a sense of shock, Lucy realized that there was a definite point in Alexander's conversation.
All this stepmother bosh, went on Alexander, still addressing the ceiling. It's really quite out of date. Lots of chaps Stoddart and I know have stepmothers. Divorce and all that, and they get on quite well together. Depends on the stepmother, of course. And, of course, it does make a bit of confusion taking you out and on sports day and all that. I mean, if there are two sets of parents. Though, again, it helps if you want to cash in.
He paused, confronted with the problems of modern life.
It's nicest to have your own home and your own parents. But if your mother's dead, well, see what I mean? If she's a decent sort, said Alexander for the third time.
Lucy felt touched. I think you're very sensible, Alexander, she said. We must try and find a nice wife for your father.
Yes,
said Alexander noncommittally. He added in an offhand manner,
I thought I'd just mention it. Brian likes you very much. He told me so.
Really, thought Lucy to herself, there's too much matchmaking round here. First Miss Marple and now Alexander. For some reason or other, pigsties came into her mind. She stood up.
Good night, Alexander. There will be only your washing things and pyjamas to put in the morning. Good night.
Good night, said Alexander. He slid down in bed, laid his head on the pillow, closed his eyes, giving a perfect picture of a sleeping angel, and was immediately asleep. Chapter 19.
Not what you'd call conclusive, said Sergeant Weatherall with his usual gloom.
Craddock was reading through the report on Harold Crackenthorpe's alibi for the 20th of December. He had been noticed at Sotheby's about 3:30, but was thought to have left shortly after that. His photograph had not been recognised at Russell's tea shop, but as they did a busy trade there at tea time, and he was not an habitué, that was hardly surprising. His manservant confirmed that he had returned to Cardigan Gardens to dress for his dinner party at 6:45, rather late, since the dinner was at 7:30, and Mr. Crackenthorpe had been somewhat irritable in consequence. Did not remember hearing him come in that evening, but as it was some time ago, could not remember accurately, and in any case he frequently did not hear Mr. Crackenthorpe come in. He and his wife liked to retire early whenever they could. The garage in the mews where Harold kept his car was a private lock-up that he rented, and there was no one to notice who came or went, or any reason to remember one evening in particular. "All negative," said Craddock with a sigh. "He was at the caterer's dinner, all right, but left rather early before the end of the speeches. What about the railway stations?" But there was nothing there, either at Brackhampton or at Paddington. It was nearly 4 weeks ago, and it was highly unlikely that anything would have been remembered. Craddock sighed and stretched out his hand for the data on Cedric. That again was negative, though a taxi driver had made a doubtful recognition of having taken a fare to Paddington that day sometime in the afternoon. What looked something like that bloke, dirty trousers and a shock of hair. Cussed and swore a bit because fares had gone up since he was last in England. He identified the day because a horse called Crawler had won the 2:30 and he'd had a tidy bit on. Just after dropping the gent, he'd heard it on the radio in his cab and had gone home, forthwith, to celebrate. "Thank God for racing," said Craddock, and put the report aside. "And here's Alfred," said Sergeant Wetherall. Some nuance in his voice made Craddock look up sharply. Wetherall had the pleased appearance of a man who has kept a titbit until the end. In the main, the check was unsatisfactory. Alfred lived alone in his flat and came and went at unspecified times. His neighbours were not the inquisitive kind, and were in any case office workers who were out all day. But towards the end of the report, Wetherall's large finger indicated the final paragraph. Sergeant Leakey, assigned to a case of thefts from lorries, had been at the Load of Bricks, a lorry pull-up on the Waddington-Brackhampton Road, keeping certain lorry drivers under observation. He had noticed at an adjoining table Chick Evans, one of the Dickie Rogers mob. With him had been Alfred Crackenthorpe, whom he knew by sight, having seen him give evidence in the Dickie Rogers case. He'd wondered what they were cooking up together. Time, 9:30 p.m. Friday the 20th of December. Alfred Crackenthorpe had boarded a bus a few minutes later, going in the direction of Brackhampton. William Baker, ticket collector at Brackhampton Station, had clipped ticket of gentleman whom he recognised by sight as one of Miss Crackenthorpe's brothers just before departure of 11:55 train for Paddington. Remembers day, as there had been a story of some batty old lady who swore she had seen somebody murdered in a train that afternoon. "Alfred?" said Craddock as he laid the report down. "Alfred? I wonder." "Puts him right on the spot there," Wetherall pointed out. Craddock nodded. Yes, Alfred could have travelled down by the 4:33 to Brackhampton, committing murder on the way. Then he could have gone out by bus to the Load of Bricks. He could have left there at 9:30 and would have had plenty of time to go to Rutherford Hall, move the body from the embankment to the sarcophagus, and get into Brackhampton in time to catch the 11:55 back to London. One of the Dickie Rogers gang might have helped him to move the body, though Craddock doubted this. An unpleasant lot, but not the killers. Alfred, he repeated speculatively. At Rutherford Hall, there had been a gathering of the Crackenthorpe family. Harold and Alfred had come down from London, and very soon voices were raised and tempers were running high. On her own initiative, Lucy mixed cocktails in a jug with ice and took them towards the library. The voices sounded clearly in the hall and indicated that a good deal of acrimony was being directed towards Emma.
"Entirely your fault, Emma," Harold's deep bass voice rang out angrily. "How you could be so short-sighted and foolish beats me. If you hadn't taken that letter to Scotland Yard and started all this..."
Alfred's higher-pitched voice said, "You must have been out of your senses."
"Now don't bully her," said Cedric. "What's done is done. Much more fishy if they'd identified the woman as the missing Martine, and we'd all kept mum about having heard from her."
"It's all very well for you, Cedric," said Harold angrily. "You were out of the country on the 20th, which seems to be the day they are inquiring about. But it's very embarrassing for Alfred and myself. Fortunately, I can remember where I was that afternoon and what I was doing."
"I bet you can," said Alfred. "If you'd arranged a murder, Harold, you'd arrange your alibi very carefully, I'm sure."
"I gather you are not so fortunate," said Harold coldly.
"Well, that depends," said Alfred. "Anything's better than presenting a cast-iron alibi to the police if it isn't really cast-iron. They're so clever at breaking these things down."
"If you are insinuating that I killed the woman..."
"Oh, do stop, all of you," cried Emma. "Of course none of you killed the woman."
"And just for your information, I wasn't out of England on the 20th, said Cedric. "And the police are wise to it. So we're all under suspicion." "If it hadn't been for Emma..."
"Oh, don't begin again, Harold," cried Emma. Dr. Quimper came out of the study where he had been closeted with old Mr. Crackenthorpe. His eye fell on the jug in Lucy's hand.
"What's this? A celebration?"
"More in the nature of oil on troubled waters. They're at it hammer and tongs in there."
"Recriminations?"
"Mostly abusing Emma." Dr. Quimper's eyebrows rose.
"Indeed."
He took the jug from Lucy's hand, opened the library door, and went in.
"Good evening." "Ah, Dr. Quimper, I should like a word with you."
It was Harold's voice, raised and irritable.
"I should like to know what you meant by interfering in a private and family matter and telling my sister to go to Scotland Yard about it."
Dr. Quimper said calmly, "Miss Crackenthorpe asked for my advice. I gave it to her. In my opinion, she did perfectly right."
"You dare to say..." "Girl!"
It was old Mr. Crackenthorpe's familiar salutation. He was peering out of the study door just behind Lucy. Lucy turned rather reluctantly. "Yes, Mr. Crackenthorpe?"
"What are you giving us for dinner tonight? I want curry. You make a very good curry. It's ages since we had curry."
"The boys don't care much for curry, you see."
"The boys? The boys? What do the boys matter? I'm the one who matters. And anyway, the boys have gone. Good riddance. I want a nice hot curry, do you hear?"
"All right, Mr. Crackenthorpe, you shall have it."
"That's right. You're a good girl, Lucy. You look after me, and I'll look after you."
Lucy went back to the kitchen. Abandoning the fricassee of chicken which she had planned, she began to assemble the preparations for curry. The front door banged, and from the window she saw Dr. Quimper stride angrily from the house to his car and drive away. Lucy sighed. She missed the boys. And in a way, she missed Brian, too. Oh, well. She sat down and began to peel mushrooms. At any rate, she'd give the family a rattling good dinner. Feed the brutes. It was 3 a.m. when Dr. Quimper drove his car into the garage, closed the doors, and came in, pulling the front door behind him rather wearily.
"Well, Mrs. Josh Simpkins had a fine, healthy pair of twins to add to her present family of 8.
Mr. Simpkins had expressed no elation over the arrival.
"Twins," he had said gloomily. "What's the good of they? Quads, no. They're good for something. All sorts of things you get sent. And the press comes round and there's pictures in the paper. And they do say Her Majesty sends you a telegram. But what's twins, except 2 mouths to feed instead of 1? Never been twins in our family, nor in the missus's either. Don't seem fair somehow.
Dr. Quimper walked upstairs to his bedroom and started throwing off his clothes. He glanced at his watch. 3:05. It had proved an unexpectedly tricky business bringing those twins into the world, but all had gone well. He yawned. He was tired. Very tired. He looked appreciatively at his bed. Then the telephone rang. Dr. Quimper swore and picked up the receiver. Dr. Quimper?
Speaking.
This is Lucy Islesbarrow from Rutherford Hall. I think you'd better come over. Everybody seems to have been taken ill.
Taken ill? How? What symptoms?
Lucy detailed them.
I'll be over straight away. In the meantime,
he gave her short, sharp instructions. Then he quickly resumed his clothes, flung a few extra things into his emergency bag, and hurried down to his car. It was some 3 hours later when the doctor and Lucy, both of them somewhat exhausted, sat down by the kitchen table to drink large cups of black coffee. Dr. Quimper drained his cup, set it down with a clatter on the saucer.
I needed that. Now, Miss Aylesborough, let's get down to brass tacks.
Lucy looked at him. The lines of fatigue showed clearly on his face, making him look older than his 44 years. The dark hair on his temples was flecked with grey, and there were lines under his eyes.
As far as I can judge, said the doctor,
they'll be all right now. But how come? That's what I want to know. Who cooked the dinner?
I did, said Lucy.
And what was it, in detail?
Mushroom soup, curried chicken and rice, syllabubs, a savoury of chicken livers and bacon.
Canapé Diane, said Dr. Quimper unexpectedly.
Lucy smiled faintly. Yes, Canapé Diane.
All right, let's go through it. Mushroom soup, out of a tin, I suppose.
Certainly not. I made it.
You made it? Out of what?
1/2 pound of mushrooms, chicken stock, milk, a roux of butter and flour, and lemon juice.
Ah. And one's supposed to say it must have been the mushrooms.
It wasn't the mushrooms. I had some of the soup myself, and I'm quite all right.
Yes, you're quite all right. I hadn't forgotten that.
Lucy flushed. If you mean...
I don't mean... You're a highly intelligent girl. You'd be groaning upstairs, too, if I'd meant what you thought I meant. Anyway, I know all about you. I've taken the trouble to find out.
Why on earth did you do that?
Dr. Quimper's lips were set in a grim line. Because I'm making it my business to find out about the people who come here and settle themselves in. You're a bona fide young woman who does this particular job for a livelihood. And you never seem to have had any contact with the Crackenthorpe family previous to coming here. So you're not a girlfriend of either Cedric, Harold, or Alfred, helping them to do a bit of dirty work.
Do you really think...
I think quite a lot of things, said Quimper, but I have to be careful. That's the worst of being a doctor. Now, let's get on.
Curried chicken. Did you have some of that?
No. When you've cooked a curry, you've dined off the smell, I find.
I tasted it, of course.
I had soup and some syllabub.
How did you serve the syllabub?
In individual glasses.
Now then, how much of all this is cleared up?
If you mean the washing up, everything was washed up and put away.
Dr. Quimper groaned. There's such a thing as being overzealous, he said.
Yes, I can see that, as things have turned out. But there it is, I'm afraid.
What do you have still?
There's some of the curry left, in a bowl in the larder. I was planning to use it as a basis for mulligatawny soup this evening. There's some mushroom soup left, too. No syllabub and none of the savoury.
I'll take the curry and the soup.
What about chutney? Did they have chutney with it?
Yes, in one of those stone jars.
I'll have some of that, too.
He rose.
I'll go up and have a look at them again.
After that, can you hold the fort until morning? Keep an eye on them all? I can have a nurse round with full instructions by 8 o'clock.
I wish you'd tell me straight out. Do you think it's food poisoning, or... Well, poisoning. I've told you already. Doctors can't think. They have to be sure. If there's a positive result from these food specimens, I can go ahead. Otherwise...
Otherwise? Lucy repeated. Dr. Quimper laid a hand on her shoulder.
Look after two people in particular, he said.
Look after Emma. I'm not going to have anything happen to Emma. There was emotion in his voice that could not be disguised. She's not even begun to live yet, he said. And, you know, people like Emma Crackenthorpe are the salt of the earth. Emma, well, Emma means a lot to me. I've never told her so, but I shall. Look after Emma.
You bet I will, said Lucy.
And look after the old man. I can't say that he's ever been my favourite patient, but he is my patient, and I'm damned if I'm going to let him be hustled out of the world because one or other of his unpleasant sons, or all three of them maybe, want him out of the way so that they can handle his money. He threw her a sudden quizzical glance. There, he said, I've opened my mouth too wide. But keep your eyes skinned, there's a good girl. And incidentally, keep your mouth shut.
Inspector Bacon was looking upset.
Arsenic? He said. Arsenic?
Yes, it was in the curry. Here's the rest of the curry for your fella to have a go at. I've only done a very rough test on a little of it, but the result was quite definite.
So there's a poisoner at work.
It would seem so, said Dr. Quimper dryly. And they're all affected, you say? Except that Miss Islesbarrow.
Except Miss Islesbarrow.
Looks a bit fishy for her.
What motive could she possibly have?
Might be balmy, suggested Bacon. Seem all right, they do, sometimes. And yet all the time they're right off their rocker, so to speak.
Miss Islesbarrow isn't off her rocker. Speaking as a medical man, Miss Islesbarrow is as sane as you or I are. If Miss Islesbarrow is feeding the family arsenic in their curry, she's doing it for a reason. Moreover, being a highly intelligent young woman, she'd be careful not to be the only one unaffected. What she'd do, what any intelligent poisoner would do, would be to eat a very little of the poisoned curry and then exaggerate the symptoms. And then you wouldn't be able to tell. That she'd had less than the others? Probably not. People don't all react alike to poisons, anyway. The same amount will upset some people more than others.
Of course, added Dr. Quimper cheerfully. Once the patient's dead, you can estimate fairly closely how much was taken.
Then it might be... Inspector Bacon paused to consolidate his ideas. It might be that there's one of the family now who's making more fuss than he need. Someone who you might say is mucking in with the rest so as to avoid arousing suspicion. How's that?
The idea's already occurred to me. That's why I'm reporting to you. It's in your hands now. I've got a nurse on the job that I can trust, but she can't be everywhere at once. In my opinion, nobody's had enough to cause death.
Made a mistake, the poisoner did?
No, it seems to me more likely that the idea was to put enough in the curry to cause signs of food poisoning, for which probably the mushrooms would be blamed. People are always obsessed with the idea of mushroom poisoning. Then one person would probably take a turn for the worse and die.
Because he'd been given a second dose?
The doctor nodded. That's why I'm reporting to you at once, and why I've put a special nurse on the job.
She knows about the arsenic?
Oh, of course. She knows, and so does Miss Islesbarrow. You know your own job best, of course, but if I were you, I'd get out there
and make it quite clear to them all that they're suffering from arsenic poisoning. That will probably put the fear of the Lord into our murderer, and he won't dare to carry out his plan. He's probably been banking on the food poisoning theory.
The telephone rang on the inspector's desk. He picked it up and said,
OK, put her through.
he said to Crimper, "It's your nurse on the phone."
"Yes?
Hello?
Speaking.
What's that? Serious relapse? Yes? Dr. Quimper's with me now. If you'd like a word with him..." He handed the receiver to the doctor.
"Quimper speaking. I see. Yes. Quite right. Yes. Carry on with that. We'll be along."
He put the receiver down and turned to Bacon. "Who is it?"
"It's Alfred," said Dr. Quimper.
"And he's dead." Chapter 20. Over the telephone, Craddock's voice came in sharp disbelief.
"Alfred," he said. "Alfred?"
Inspector Bacon, shifting the telephone receiver a little, said,
"You didn't expect that?" "No, indeed. As a matter of fact, I'd just got him taped for the murderer." "I heard about him being spotted by the ticket collector. Looked bad for him, all right." "Yes, looked as though we'd got our man."
"Well," said Craddock flatly, "we were wrong." There was a moment's silence. Then Craddock asked, "There was a nurse in charge. How did she come to slip up?"
"Can't blame her. Miss Islesborough was all in and went to get a bit of sleep. The nurse had got 5 patients on her hands. The old man, Emma, Cedric, Harold, and Alfred. She couldn't be everywhere at once. It seems old Mr. Crackenthorpe started creating in a big way. Said he was dying. She went in, got him soothed down, came back again, and took Alfred in some tea with glucose. He drank it, and that was that. Arsenic again. Seems so. Of course, it could have been a relapse, but Quimper doesn't think so, and Johnson agrees."
"I suppose," said Craddock doubtfully, "that Alfred was meant to be the victim." Bacon sounded interested. "You mean that whereas Alfred's death wouldn't do anyone that penneth a good, the old man's death would benefit the lot of them? I suppose it might have been a mistake. Somebody might have thought the tea was intended for the old man."
"Are they sure that that's the way the stuff was administered?"
"No, of course they aren't sure. The nurse, like a good nurse, washed up the whole contraption. Cups, spoons, teapot, everything. But it seems the only feasible method."
"Meaning," said Craddock thoughtfully, "that one of the patients wasn't as ill as the others. Saw his chance and doped the cup."
"Well, there won't be any more funny business," said Inspector Bacon grimly. "We've got 2 nurses on the job now, to say nothing of Miss Islesborough, and I've got a couple of men there too. You coming down?"
"As fast as I can make it." Lucy Islesborough came across the hall to meet Inspector Craddock. She looked pale and drawn.
"You've been having a bad time of it," said Craddock.
"It's been like one long, ghastly nightmare," said Lucy. "I really thought last night that they were all dying. About this curry. It was the curry?"
"Yes. Very nicely laced with arsenic. Quite the Borgia touch."
"If that's true," said Lucy, "it must... it's got to be one of the family."
"No other possibility?"
"No. You see, I only started making that damned curry quite late. After 6 o'clock, because Mr. Crackenthorpe specially asked for curry. And I had to open a new tin of curry powder, so that couldn't have been tampered with. I suppose curry would disguise the taste."
"Arsenic hasn't any taste," said Craddock absently. "Now, opportunity. Which of them had the chance to tamper with the curry while it was cooking?"
Lucy considered. "Well, actually," she said, "anyone could have sneaked into the kitchen whilst I was laying the table in the dining room."
"I see. Now, who was there in the house? Old Mr. Crackenthorpe, Emma, Cedric,
Harold and Alfred. They'd come down from London in the afternoon. Oh, and Brian Eastley. But he left just before dinner. He had to meet a man in Brackhampton. Craddock said thoughtfully, "It ties up with the old man's illness at Christmas. Quimper suspected that that was arsenic. Did they all seem equally ill last night?" Lucy considered. "I think old Mr. Crackenthorpe seemed the worst. Dr. Quimper had to work like a maniac on him. He's a jolly good doctor, I will say. Cedric made by far the most fuss. Of course, strong, healthy people always do. What about Emma?" "She has been pretty bad." "Why Alfred, I wonder," said Craddock. "I know," said Lucy. "I suppose it was meant to be Alfred." "Funny, I asked that too. It seems, somehow, so pointless. If I could only get at the motive for all this business," said Craddock. "It doesn't seem to tie up." The strangled woman in the sarcophagus was Edmund Crackenthorpe's widow, Martine. Let's assume that. It's pretty well proved by now. There must be a connection between that and the deliberate poisoning of Alfred. It's all here, in the family, somewhere. Even saying one of them's mad doesn't help. "Not really," Lucy agreed. "Well, look after yourself," said Craddock warningly. "There's a poisoner in this house, remember, and one of your patients upstairs probably isn't as ill as he pretends to be." Lucy went upstairs again slowly after Craddock's departure. An imperious voice, somewhat weakened by illness, called to her as she passed old Mr. Crackenthorpe's room.
"Girl! Girl! Is that you? Come here."
Lucy entered the room. Mr. Crackenthorpe was lying in bed, well propped up with pillows. For a sick man, he was looking, Lucy thought, remarkably cheerful.
"The house is full of damned hospital nurses," complained Mr. Crackenthorpe, "rustling about, making themselves important, taking my temperature, not giving me what I want to eat. A pretty penny all that must be costing. Tell Emma to send them away. You could look after me quite well."
"Everybody's been taken ill, Mr. Crackenthorpe," said Lucy. "I can't look after everybody, you know."
"Mushrooms," said Mr. Crackenthorpe. "Damn dangerous things, mushrooms. It was that soup we had last night. You made it,"
he added accusingly. "The mushrooms were quite all right, Mr. Crackenthorpe."
"I'm not blaming you, girl. I'm not blaming you. It's happened before. One blasted fungus slips in and does it. Nobody can tell. I know you're a good girl. You wouldn't do it on purpose. How's Emma?"
"Feeling rather better this afternoon."
"Ah. And Harold?"
"He's better too."
"What's this about Alfred having kicked the bucket?"
"Nobody's supposed to have told you that, Mr. Crackenthorpe."
Mr. Crackenthorpe laughed, a high, whinnying laugh of intense amusement. "Oh, I hear things," he said. "Can't keep things from the old man. They try to. So, Alfred's dead, is he? He won't sponge on me any more, and he won't get any of the money either. They've all been waiting for me to die, you know, Alfred in particular. Now he's dead." "I call that rather a good joke."
"That's not very kind of you, Mr. Crackenthorpe," said Lucy severely. Mr. Crackenthorpe laughed again.
"Oh, I'll outlive them all," he crowed. "You see if I don't, my girl. You see if I don't."
Lucy went to her room. She took out her dictionary and looked up the word tontine. She closed the book thoughtfully and stared ahead of her.
"Don't see why you want to come to me," said Dr. Morris irritably.
"You've known the Crackenthorpe family a long time," said Inspector Craddock.
"Yes, yes, I knew all the Crackenthorpes. I remember old Josiah Crackenthorpe. He was a hard nut. Shrewd man, though. Made a lot of money.
He shifted his aged form in his chair and peered under bushy eyebrows at Inspector Craddock.
"So, you've been listening to that young fool Quimper," he said. "These zealous young doctors, always getting ideas in their heads. Got it into his head that somebody was trying to poison Luther Crackenthorpe. Nonsense and melodrama. Of course he had gastric attacks. I treated him for them. Didn't happen very often. Nothing peculiar about them."
"Dr. Quimper," said Craddock, "seemed to think there was."
"Doesn't do for a doctor to go thinking. After all, I should hope I could recognize arsenical poisoning when I saw it."
"Quite a lot of well-known doctors haven't noticed it," Craddock pointed out. "There was," he drew upon his memory, "the Greenberry case, Mrs. Rainey, Charles Leeds, three people in the Westbury family, all buried nicely and tidily without the doctors who attended them having the least suspicion. Those doctors were all good, reputable men."
"All right, all right," said Dr. Morris.
"You're saying that I could have made a mistake. Well, I don't think I did."
He paused a minute and then said,
"Well, who did Quimper think was doing it, if it was being done?"
"He didn't know," said Craddock. "He was worried. After all, you know," he added, "there's a great deal of money there."
"Oh, yes, yes, I know, which they'll get when Luther Crackenthorpe dies. And they want it pretty badly."
"That is true enough, but it doesn't follow that they'd kill the old man to get it."
"Not necessarily," agreed Inspector Craddock.
"Anyway," said Dr. Morris, "my principle is not to go about suspecting things without due cause."
"Due cause," he repeated.
"I'll admit that what you've just told me has shaken me up a bit. Arsenic on a big scale, apparently. But I still don't see why you come to me. All I can tell you is that I didn't suspect it. Maybe I should have. Maybe I should have taken those gastric attacks of Luther Crackenthorpe's much more seriously. But you've got a long way beyond that now."
Craddock agreed. "What I really need," he said, "is to know a little more about the Crackenthorpe family. Is there any queer mental strain in them? A kink of any kind?" The eyes under the bushy eyebrows looked at him sharply.
"Yes, I can see your thoughts might run that way. Well, old Josiah was sane enough. Hard as nails, very much all there. His wife was neurotic, had a tendency to melancholia, came of an inbred family. She died soon after her second son was born. I'd say, you know, that Luther inherited a certain, well, instability from her. He was commonplace enough as a young man, but he was always at loggerheads with his father. His father was disappointed in him, and I think he resented that and brooded on it, and in the end got a kind of obsession about it. He carried that on into his own married life. You'll notice, if you talk to him at all, that he's got a hearty dislike for all his own sons. His daughters he was fond of, both Emma and Edie, the one who died."
"Why does he dislike the sons so much?" asked Craddock.
You'll have to go to one of these new-fashioned psychiatrists to find that out. I'd just say that Luther has never felt very adequate as a man himself, and that he bitterly resents his financial position. He has possession of an income, but no power of appointment of capital. If he had the power to disinherit his sons, he probably wouldn't dislike them as much. Being powerless in that respect gives him a feeling of humiliation."
"That's why he's so pleased at the idea of outliving them all," said Inspector Craddock.
"Possibly. It is the root, too, of his parsimony, I think. I should say that he's managed to save a considerable sum out of his large income, mostly, of course, before taxation rose to its present giddy heights."
A new idea struck Inspector Craddock.
I suppose he's left his savings by will to someone. That he can do.
Oh, yes. Though God knows who he has left it to. Maybe to Emma, but I should rather doubt it. She'll get her share of the old man's money. Maybe to Alexander, the grandson.
He's fond of him, is he? Said Craddock.
Well, used to be. Of course, he was his daughter's child, not his son's child. That may have made a difference. And he had quite an affection for Brian Eastley, Edie's husband. Of course, I don't know Brian well. It's some years since I've seen any of the family. But it struck me that he was going to be very much at a loose end after the war. He's got those qualities that you need in wartime. Courage, dash, and the tendency to let the future take care of itself. But I don't think he's got any stability. He'll probably turn into a drifter. As far as you know, there's no peculiar kink in any of the younger generation.
Cedric's an eccentric type, one of those natural rebels. I wouldn't say he was perfectly normal, but you might say who is.
Harold's fairly orthodox. Not what I call a very pleasant character. Cold-hearted, eye to the main chance.
Alfred's got a touch of the delinquent about him. He's a wrong one. Always was. Saw him taking money out of a missionary box once that they used to keep in the hall. I mean, that type of thing. Ah, well. The poor fellow's dead. I suppose I shouldn't be talking against him.
What about... Craddock hesitated. Emma Crackenthorpe.
Nice girl. Quiet. One doesn't always know what she's thinking. Has her own plans and her own ideas, but she keeps them to herself. She's more character than you might think from her general manner and appearance.
You knew Edmund, I suppose, the son who was killed in France.
Yes. Oh, he was the best of the bunch, I'd say. Good-hearted, gay, a nice boy.
Did you ever hear that he was going to marry, or had married, a French girl just before he was killed?
Dr. Morris frowned.
It seems as though I remember something about it, he said, but it's a long time ago.
Quite early on in the war, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh, well. I dare say he'd have lived to regret it if he had married a foreign wife.
There's some reason to believe that he did do just that, said Craddock. In a few brief sentences, he gave an account of recent happenings.
I remember seeing something in the papers about a woman found in a sarcophagus. So, it was at Rutherford Hall.
And there's reason to believe that the woman was Edmund Crackenthorpe's widow.
Well, well. That seems extraordinary. More like a novel than real life. But who'd want to kill the poor thing? I mean, how does it tie up with arsenical poisoning in the Crackenthorpe family?
In one of two ways, said Craddock. But they are both very far-fetched. Somebody perhaps is greedy and wants the whole of Josiah Crackenthorpe's fortune.
Damn fool if he does, said Dr. Morris. He'll only have to pay the most stupendous taxes on the income from it.
Chapter 21
Nasty things, mushrooms, said Mrs. Kidder.
Mrs. Kidder had made the same remark about 10 times in the last few days. Lucy did not reply.
Never touch them myself, said Mrs. Kidder. Much too dangerous. It's a merciful providence as there's only been one death. The whole lot might have gone, and you too, miss. A wonderful escape you've had.
It wasn't the mushrooms, said Lucy. They were perfectly all right.
Don't you believe it, said Mrs. Kidder. Dangerous they are, mushrooms. One toadstool in among the lot, and you've had it.
Funny, went on Mrs. Kidder, among the rattle of plates and dishes in the sink,
how things seem to come all together, as it were. My sister's eldest had measles.
and our Ernie fell down and broke his arm, and my husband came out all over with boils. All in the same week. You'd hardly believe it, would you? It's been the same thing here, went on Mrs. Kidder. First that nasty murder, and now Mr. Alfred dead with mushroom poisoning. Who'll be the next, I'd like to know.
Lucy felt rather uncomfortably that she would like to know, too.
My husband, he doesn't like me coming here now, said Mrs. Kidder. Thinks it's unlucky. But what I say is, I've known Miss Crackenthorpe a long time now, and she's a nice lady, and she depends on me. And I couldn't leave poor Miss Islesbarrow, I said, not to do everything herself in the house. Pretty hard it is on you, miss, all these trays.
Lucy was forced to agree that life did seem to consist very largely of trays at the moment. She was, at the moment, arranging trays to take to the various invalids.
As for them nurses, they never do Anne's turn, said Mrs. Kidder. All they want is pots and pots of tea made strong, and meals prepared. Wore out, that's what I am.
She spoke in a tone of great satisfaction, though actually she had done very little more than her normal morning's work. Lucy said solemnly,
You never spare yourself, Mrs. Kidder.
Mrs. Kidder looked pleased. Lucy picked up the first of the trays and started off up the stairs.
What's this? Said Mr. Crackenthorpe disapprovingly.
Beef tea and baked custard, said Lucy.
Take it away, said Mr. Crackenthorpe. I won't touch that sort of stuff. I told that nurse I wanted a beef steak.
Dr. Quimper thinks you ought not to have beef steak just yet, said Lucy. Mr. Crackenthorpe snorted.
I'm practically well again. I'm getting up tomorrow. How are the others?
Mr. Harold's much better, said Lucy. He's going back to London tomorrow.
Good riddance, said Mr. Crackenthorpe. What about Cedric? Any hope that he's going back to his island tomorrow?
He won't be going just yet.
Pity. What's Emma doing? Why doesn't she come and see me?
She's still in bed, Mr. Crackenthorpe.
Women always coddle themselves, said Mr. Crackenthorpe. But you're a good, strong girl, he added approvingly. Run about all day, don't you?
I get plenty of exercise, said Lucy. Old Mr. Crackenthorpe nodded his head approvingly.
You're a good, strong girl, he said. And don't think I've forgotten what I talked to you about before. One of these days you'll see what you'll see. Emma isn't always going to have things her own way. And don't listen to the others when they tell you I'm a mean old man. I'm careful of my money. I've got a nice little packet put by, and I know who I'm going to spend it on when the time comes.
He leered at her affectionately. Lucy went rather quickly out of the room, avoiding his clutching hand. The next tray was taken into Emma.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. I'm really feeling quite myself again by now. I'm hungry, and that's a good sign, isn't it?
My dear, went on Emma as Lucy settled the tray on her knees, I'm really feeling very upset about your aunt.
You haven't had any time to go and see her, I suppose.
No, I haven't, as a matter of fact.
I'm afraid she must be missing you.
Oh, don't worry, Miss Crackenthorpe. She understands what a terrible time we've been through.
Have you rung her up?
No, I haven't, just lately.
Well, do. Ring her up every day. It makes such a difference to old people to get news.
You're very kind, said Lucy. Her conscience smote her a little as she went down to fetch the next tray. The complications of illness in a house had kept her thoroughly absorbed, and she had had no time to think of anything else. She decided that she would ring Miss Marple up as soon as she had taken Cedric his meal. There was only one nurse in the house now, and she passed Lucy on the landing, exchanging greetings. Cedric, looking incredibly tidied up and neat, was sitting up in bed writing busily on sheets of paper.
Hello, Lucy, he said.
What hell brew have you got for me today? I wish you'd get rid of that god-awful nurse. She's simply too arch for words. Calls me we for some reason. And how are we this morning? Have we slept well? Oh, dear, we're very naughty, throwing off the bedclothes like that. You seem very cheerful, said Lucy. What are you busy with?
Plans, said Cedric.
Plans for what to do with this place when the old man pops off. It's a jolly good bit of land here, you know. I can't make up my mind whether I'd like to develop some of it myself or whether I'll sell it in lots all in one go. Very valuable for industrial purposes. The house will do for a nursing home or a school. I'm not sure I shan't sell half the land and use the money to do something rather outrageous with the other half. What do you think?
You haven't got it yet, said Lucy dryly.
I shall have it, though, said Cedric. It's not divided up like the other stuff. I get it outright. And if I sell it for a good fat price, the money will be capital, not income, so I shan't have to pay taxes on it.
Money to burn, think of it.
I always understood you rather despised money, said Lucy.
Well, of course I despise money when I haven't got any, said Cedric. It's the only dignified thing to do. What a lovely girl you are, Lucy. Or do I just think so because I haven't seen any good-looking women for a long time?
I expect that's it, said Lucy.
Still busy tidying everyone and everything up.
Somebody seems to have been tidying you up, said Lucy, looking at him.
That's that damn nurse, said Cedric with feeling. Have they had the inquest on Alfred yet? What happened?
It was adjourned, said Lucy.
Police being cagey. This mass poisoning does give one a bit of a turn, doesn't it? Mentally, I mean. I'm not referring to more obvious aspects. He added, better look after yourself, Miguel.
I do, said Lucy.
Has young Alexander gone back to school yet?
I think he's still with the Stoddart Wests. I think it's the day after tomorrow that school begins. Before getting her own lunch, Lucy went to the telephone and rang up Miss Marple. I'm so terribly sorry I haven't been able to come over, but I've really been very busy.
Of course, my dear, of course. Besides, there's nothing that can be done just now. We just have to wait.
Yes, but what are we waiting for?
Elspeth McGillicuddy ought to be home very soon now, said Miss Marple. I wrote to her to fly home at once. I said it was her duty, so don't worry too much, my dear.
Her voice was kindly and reassuring. You don't think, Lucy began but stopped,
that there will be any more deaths? Oh, I hope not, my dear. But one never knows, does one? When anyone is really wicked, I mean. And I think there is great wickedness here.
Or madness, said Lucy.
Of course, I know that is the modern way of looking at things. I don't agree myself.
End of Disc 5.